When people return to work after being unemployed for a long stretch, their new job often is not as good as the one they lost. That's just one of the difficult realities faced by the people we're profiling as part of our Road Back to Work series. For the next year, we're following 6 unemployed people in St. Louis, and we've given them recording equipment to document their job search. Today, NPR's Tamara Keith updates us on 3 of our job seekers.
When we first met Randy Howland, he had been out of work for more than a year.
It's Thursday, January 6th. It's in the morning. You know, one advantage that that Lisa has, my wife, is that me being out of work, I get to make breakfast for her.
Howland's career peaked back in 2002. He was making more than $100,000 a year, working for the telecom giant WorldCom. Then the company went bust. He's held a series of lower-wage jobs since then. Even though Howland is 50 years old and has a master's degree, the jobs he's been applying for most recently have been entry-level positions in sales and customer service.
If I'm not bringing in the bacon, so to speak, I better make some bacon.
Howland has applied for more than 600 jobs in the last year. And finally, in the dead of winter, there's an opportunity, an actual job offer. It's not perfect. It's a call center type position where he'd take customer service calls from home. The pay is low. With taxes taken out, it's less than Howland was getting on unemployment.
This is Randy. It's Thursday, February 3rd. Tomorrow I start my new job. My salary will be an exciting $10 an hour. It's 1/5 of where I was at my peak. Of course, it's better than where I was when I was 21. Again, I'm 50. We'll see.
In the job, he's doing customer service for a telecommunications company. He's back in the industry where he once thrived. And that makes him happy, even if the pay hurts his pride.
It's time. I've been sucking government money for quite a bit. So I'm sucking it up, and with my wife's income as a hairdresser, we can barely wing it, but I think we can do it.
He's settling for less, and he's not alone.
Hello, this is Jennifer and Brian together. It is Tuesday, January 25th. It's 5:30 p.m.
Jennifer and Brian Barfield are newlyweds. She's 47, he's 53. They met at a networking group for unemployed people in St. Louis. Brian spent his career in manufacturing. Jennifer is an IT professional.
Brian today had to take a test for a particular job that he had applied for. And I'm going to hand this over to Brian and let him talk about how it went. So here you go, honey.
I took my time with the answers and got them correct. And I end up passing the test with flying colors. I go back next week for a interview with the plant manager and the department managers to see if or where they'll put me in the plant.
It's a warehouse position at a major St. Louis company. It's a weekend job, just part-time, and he wouldn't be a manager, so a step down from his last job.
Hello. It is late Wednesday night, early Thursday morning. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning on February 3rd. We're up here. My lovely wife is ironing my shirt, getting ready for my interview first thing in the morning.
This may not be his dream job, but the Barfields need the income.
So I assume if everything goes well tomorrow, they'll have assigned me a department. If everything doesn't go well, I guess I come home without that job.
And he really wants that job.
It's Friday, February 4th. And I just got a call, and I have been accepted. It's 2 days a week, but it's way more than unemployment is, and it's a chance to get on permanent.
He'll continue applying for full-time positions at other companies, too, hoping someday to work 2 jobs. According to government data, more than 8 million Americans are working part-time now, but want to have full-time jobs. But at least they have jobs. Brian's wife, Jennifer, is nearing 2 years of being unemployed.
Hi, this is Jennifer. It is February 7th at 12:22 a.m. Well, I've had a bad day. The day started off for me with a message from a recruiter about a job that I had interviewed for last week. that they said on the voicemail that the company just passed on me and didn't give any feedback as to why.
It was her third rejection in 2 days. She still has a few irons in the fire, as she calls them, but they seem to be going cold. Even with Brian's new job, money is tight.
It's just our situation. It's so frustrating to me. And right now I'm so down. I'm just questioning everything from spiritual issues to what's the point of, you know, living life if this is all it is. And no, I'm not suicidal or anything like that, but I'm just really frustrated.
For Jennifer, Brian, Randy, and so many others, life after a job loss isn't what it was before. There's a new normal, and the adjustment hurts. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
And for more on the Road Back to Work series, visit npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The budget battles taking shape in Washington, D.C. and in states like Wisconsin and Ohio have a few things in common: huge deficits and newly elected Republicans committed to deep spending cuts. NPR's Don Gagne is in Ohio this week, and he's found another common denominator among both supporters and opponents of those budget cuts: economic anxiety.
In Columbus this week, the chants of union members gathered inside the atrium of the Capitol building echoed with familiarity.
Mighty, mighty union! Everywhere we go!
But for these state workers, teachers, firefighters, police officers, clerks, and others, the stakes are higher than they've ever been. Bruce Bostick is a retired steel worker who came to lend support.
What this is about is it's an attack on all working people. It is not just about unions. And now we're supposed to pay to keep budgets afloat after they've given billionaires an opt-out in this situation. And we say it's about time we had some doggone fairness.
50-year-old Barb Phillips is a union school bus driver in Ashland, Ohio. She says the specific provisions now before the Ohio Senate, including ending collective bargaining for unionized state employees, put the union's very viability at risk.
Take out the voice of safe workplace. Take the voice out of our rights on even talking with management.
Phillips says she sees the current battle as Republican revenge for the health care law passed by the last U.S. Congress, controlled by Democrats, and signed by President Obama.
We had the majority of the House. We had the majority of the Senate. We passed the biggest legislation for health care accessibility for the country. That's what I mean about revenge.
Much of the dialogue on government spending and how and where to cut has been noisy, as it has been in Columbus. But the discussion is happening in all kinds of venues.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming this evening and being with us. As you know, with us is Congressman Gibbs this evening. We're going to go around the table and introduce ourselves to the
This low-key gathering is in the basement conference room of the Licking County Chamber of Commerce in central Ohio. A dozen members of the group's Government Affairs Committee have invited their new Republican Congressman, Bob Gibbs, to stop by. Gibbs is a conservative. He's a former state senator, a farmer. He's not a member of the House Tea Party caucus, but he tells the group he's pleased with the cuts the new Republican-controlled U.S. House has made so far.
People need to start realizing in this country that if we don't change what's happening, we will not have a country. And it's also, at best, our kids have a lower standard of living and quality of life. That's at best. At worst, I don't even want to think about it.
Chamber of Commerce member Tim Fitterer says he hopes the Congress takes its work reducing spending very seriously. Fitterer is a vice president with a local trucking firm. He's caught between fear of what the debt means and worries about new and changing regulations for his industry, and, as he tells the congressman, about the fact that he's not feeling the economic recovery.
We haul freight all over the country, and we're dragging still. Congressman, it's not picking up. What it is, you said uncertainty. I call it fear.
Well, there is fear.
There is tremendous fear.
Fitterer says that has a huge impact on his business. Fear, too, is driving the protests by union members in Columbus and Madison. It's the one thing they have in common in their very different perspectives on the debate in Washington and in state capitals. Don Gagne, NPR News, Columbus.
In Chicago today, Mayor-elect Rahm Emanuel was out to thank the voters.
Nice to see you. Take care. Good to see you. Have a good day.
Congratulations.
Nice to see you.
The former White House chief of staff greeted people at an L stop, as he has throughout his campaign. Now he meets the public with new responsibilities on his shoulders. Emanuel will take the helm in a city with a budget deficit of more than $600 million. NPR's Cheryl Corley has been covering the mayoral race, and she joins us now from the Windy City. Cheryl, Rahm Emanuel could have ended up in a runoff with another candidate, but he ended up winning not just a plurality, but a majority. Was that a surprise in Chicago?
Well, yes and no, and here's why. First, there had been this big expectation that Rahm Emanuel would absolutely dominate this race. He had millions in campaign funds. Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton, came in to endorse him. And, of course, he had this connection with President Obama. So he was definitely the force to be reckoned with. But there was also that yes factor because he had faced five other opponents. Three were considered major rivals. There was some expectation that among them they would get enough votes to force a runoff. But that ultimately was not the case. He ended up getting 55% of the vote.
What are the biggest challenges he faces?
Well, of course, the city has this huge budget deficit, and Emanuel has promised to cut $75 million in this year's budget. He wants a forensic audit before he makes any kind of recommendations. But the budget deficit, big pension issues, those are some of the things that he's going to face. He says Chicago isn't alone in facing budget and pension problems, but there's a way to go about solving them.
I reject the way Wisconsin has approached this. My goal is to solve the reforms here and work together in a cooperative basis to do it.
Other things that Emanuel says he would do, he would not go for a property tax. He would broaden the city's sales tax, cutting it in some areas and including some services that aren't affected by the sales tax now.
We just heard Mayor-elect Emanuel talking about working in a cooperative spirit. How is he expected to work with the large and raucous city council, all those aldermen who will have something to say about how the city is run?
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge. There are 50 aldermen in the Chicago City Council, and many of them are going to be new. He's also has to forge some relationship with aldermen who have been there a long time. Alderman Ed Burke, who has the Finance Committee, for instance, is a powerhouse in the city council. He endorsed one of Rahm Emanuel's opponents in this race.
So, and he's been there for decades.
So we'll see how that goes.
Even before Rahm Emanuel was sworn in, one of the major papers in Chicago, the Chicago Sun-Times, ran a headline that said this: big problems, painful solutions could seal Emanuel's fate as one-termer. It seems like some are saying that he's in a no-win situation.
In many ways, he is. I mean, he's going to have to make some very tough choices. I mean, anybody, any mayor coming into Chicago at this point would have to make some really hard decisions. And, you know, that might not bode well for a person running for election down the road.
This was the first time in more than 20 years that a daily was not on the ballot. What do voters that you talk to in Chicago have to say about Rahm Emanuel?
Well, I think that they believe that Rahm Emanuel in some ways is very daily-like. A tough guy, a person who sets goals and will reach those goals. And they also like the fact that, like Mayor Daley, he has lots of connections. And I think that's why you saw Rahm Emanuel end up with 55% of the vote.
Cheryl Corley, thanks so much.
You're quite welcome.
That's NPR's Cheryl Corley in Chicago.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
When we talk about what's on the table in collective bargaining, we're talking about more than wages and benefits. Unions negotiate over a wide range of workplace issues, as NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
When a school district or a county government signs a union contract, the headline often announces what kind of pay raise or health care plan the union got. But buried in those agreements are complex rules that are often just as important as money to workers. Angela Aldous is a nurse on the cancer ward of the University of Wisconsin Hospital, where she often oversees chemotherapy. Her union successfully argued that one nurse should never have to care for more than four patients at a time. It was a matter of public safety.
When you're trying to verify chemo, hang the chemo, give it safely, educate the patient, and heaven forbid have time to comfort the patient as they go through cancer, you can't take more than four patients.
Aldous could lose the right to bargain over such issues if Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is able to pass his proposal to limit collective bargaining. Teachers' contracts often get more scrutiny because parents are concerned about class size, something that is often a subject of bargaining. Mary Bell, head of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, says her members use collective bargaining to speak up on behalf of students.
What your voice is in setting curriculum, how it is that you decide things about grade levels and how different issues that the workplace really needs to do in order to advocate for students.
But for administrators, collective bargaining can feel more like a straitjacket. John Ashley is head of the Wisconsin Association of School Boards. Some of his members want to team up with neighboring schools to cut costs, but that violates so-called exclusivity clauses.
Those exclusivity clauses require all our classes offered by a district to be supervised by a member of the district union, even if the course is being taught by a fully certified and licensed teacher from another district.
Ashley says that's how bargaining affects spending, even when wages and benefits are not directly involved. In recent years, education reformers have begun to complain that teachers' contracts limit experimentation because administrators cannot change the length of the school day, for example, without consulting the union. By far the biggest complaint is aimed at labor's role in hiring, firing, and layoffs. Former D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee butted heads with the local union when she tried to fire ineffective teachers and reward top performers. Now, as head of an advocacy group called Students First, Rhee has released a new video attacking seniority rules.
When you do seniority-based layoffs, we actually end up cutting some of our most effective teachers. We actually end up having to lay off more teachers and lose more jobs because the junior teachers are paid the least, and we need to fire more of them in order to make up the budget deficit.
Seniority and tenure rights could be eaten away if new laws pass in Wisconsin, Indiana, and elsewhere, but only if local administrators take advantage of them. Many districts may end up sticking with the status quo, at least for now. Patrick Henniger advises local governments for the Wisconsin-based law firm Phillips Borowski. He says collective bargaining gives management a level of comfort.
One thing, when you have a contract in place, you're forced to be consistent in the way you make your employment decisions. And I think that's still a concern going forward for any of these school districts and municipal employers.
Henniger says if these laws pass, school districts and local governments are going to need lots of legal advice on how to operate in this new world. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.